several bright and distant lights performing conspicuous maneuvers, as he had put it, didn't fit with what Trey had just seen. But recalling the rest of the man's experience, the experience of the incredible sight he witnessed not showing up in any of his footage, caused Trey's heart rate to soar all over again. Trey clicked his floodlight to life, instantly illuminating a small circle around him, then stopped recording on his primary handheld camera and navigated through its touchscreen menu to replay some footage. When he realized he would have to fast-forward through many minutes of nothing on this camera, and that his motion-tracking camera would provide a far quicker answer by either reporting a tracked event or not, he moved towards it instead. He walked with his fingers crossed, hoping and praying that the footage would be there. If it was, nothing would ever be the same. If it wasn't, well, he didn't even want to think about that. Either way, his own perspective on the messengers would never be the same, and he would be sure to get an answer from Dan as to how he had known something was going to happen, where and when it did. He also knew that Dan would live up to his promise of making the exhausting trip to Lolo financially worthwhile. Dan always lived up to his promises, but that would do little to ease the crushing disappointment should the craft prove to have been unrecordable. Trey didn't want to think about this, but he couldn't help it. The will it or won't it be there question felt like the only thing in the world as it circled and spiraled in Trey's mind with each of his steps towards the motion-tracking camera. It circled and spiraled, faster and deeper, until something else blew it out of the water. This something else slackened Trey's jaw all over again, and sent his fingers fumbling to both kill the floodlight and reactivate his handheld camera. For high in the sky, in roughly the same area from which the extraordinary craft had first appeared, a meteor-like trail was rapidly forming as something, some unknown thing, pierced through Earth's atmosphere and either plummeted towards the surface or burned up towards its death. Trey stood only a few feet from the motion-tracking camera and heard its small motor whirring as it turned to focus on the new visual stimulus its sensors had detected. That same new stimulus brought a new word to the front of Trey's mind as he focused his eyes and handheld camera on the ever-extending trail of fire. Kerguelen. Whatever was falling from the sky looked passably like the meteor which had exploded over Kerguelen, and although Trey was perfectly placed to capture unobstructed footage if this object exploded, it looked close enough for him to hope and pray that it didn't. To his relief, the object burned up very quickly and died with a fizzle rather than a bang, leaving a relatively short and unusually vertical trail in its wake. Trey felt confident that his readiness meant that he would have the best footage of the object's short-lived appearance within Earth's atmosphere. But he also knew that its brief brightness, combined with the prominence and longevity of its trail, would ensure that there would be plenty of eyewitnesses to turn it into another media event. And coming so soon after Kerguelen, questions were bound to be asked as to whether there might be a connection between the two incidents. But what would normally have been the biggest sighting of Trey's year was a distant runner-up to what had come moments earlier. And as soon as he was absolutely sure that no sonic boom was looming, he switched his handheld camera off again and finally got down to the all-important analysis of the motion-tracking camera's footage. Trey Myers had seen a UFO. He had seen an alien craft, and nothing could ever take that away from him. But when it came to sharing it with the world, everything rested on whether his cameras had been able to capture the amazing sight of the low-flying vessel, or whether some kind of cloaking mechanism or electrical interference would result in the footage containing a heartbreakingly empty sky, or even an error message about corrupted data. Trey pushed a button to stop the motion-tracking camera's ongoing recording, and then held his breath as he instructed it to play back the recording from the first sky-based visual stimulus it had detected. On the small screen, a bright flash appeared, and soon became locked in the center of the picture as the camera tracked its movement. "Don't disappear," Trey pleaded as the small light grew closer. "Please don't disappear." His heart rate reached all new levels with each passing moment, until a throaty laugh of disbelief escaped his open mouth when the craft came close enough for the detail on its underside to come into clear visibility. Trey fell to his knees and threw his hands to his head in a display of unprecedented joy, casting a silhouette that might well have struck an outside observer as that of a man in despair rather than one who had just hit the jackpot. The global significance of what Trey had just recorded was not lost on him, but he couldn't help but think primarily of what it was going to do for him and his young family. While Emma and Dan had generously rewarded Trey's loyalty in the past, recent months had been lean for the Blue Dish Network business he ran with his wife. Their business model, based on being the first professionals on the scene of developing news incidents and selling their footage to major networks, was being squeezed tighter every day by the total market penetration of HD smartphones and the near-total spread of fast mobile internet, which allowed everyone to live stream such incidents from almost anywhere. But tonight, at Lolo, Trey wasn't just the first responder of the media world, he was the only show in town. He was too caught up in the joy of the moment to think much about why the messengers were back and how Dan had known they were coming, much less why their low flight over his head had preceded what looked like the arrival of another sizable meteor. For now, while Trey Myers gathered up his equipment and the priceless footage contained within it, only one thought rose high above the others in his mind. Thank you, Dan. C-31. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Dan began his explanation as to why he'd sent Trey to Lolo with a brief recap of his own trip to Richard Walker's cornfield, during which he had seen a clear vision of a triangle in the sky over the familiar valley, and after which he had conversed with Walker himself. Emma was stunned from the very beginning. "You spoke to Walker?" she asked, for starters. "After they called you there again without you knowing, just like last year?" Dan nodded and continued to the more recent part, when only 22 hours ago he had received a second message of sorts in the form of a dream which told him the precise time when something big was going to happen at Lolo. Emma's next questions for the brothers were the obvious ones. Why hadn't they discussed any of this with her before now, and why had they sent Trey rather than themselves? Dan automatically recited the answers, obvious in his mind. She hadn't picked up his earlier calls, and he hadn't been called to Lolo like last year. This time he had been alerted to Lolo. Clark butted in to repeat what he'd told Dan about the difficulty they would have faced in reaching Lolo themselves without being seen and without struggling to justify a sudden and unplanned two-day road trip. "We didn't make this decision behind your back," Clark said to Emma. "Your back wasn't here." To Dan's mild surprise, Emma didn't display any outward signs of disagreeing with their course of action. Indeed, just a few seconds later, she voiced her support. "Trey was probably the best choice you had. We can trust him to come to us first with whatever he sees, before he goes public with it." A grin then crossed her face. "And at least you didn't send Tara." Dan and Clark shared a quick and uneasy look, as though wordlessly discussing whether or not this was a good time to tell Emma that Tara had seen Richard Walker after following their car to his place for an innocuous reason. Since it hadn't directly involved the messengers or any other external developments, Dan hadn't even mentioned this second trip to Walker's in his brief recap of recent events, and now very subtly shook his head to tell Clark that this wasn't the time to tell Emma anything about Tara. All of that could wait for tomorrow, once Tara was awake and Trey had reported his findings. But despite the subtleness of Dan's head-shaking signal, the silent exchange which preceded it had gone on long enough for Emma to notice. "What was that look?" she asked. "You didn't ask Tara to go before you asked Trey, did you?" "Of course not," Dan said, surprised Emma would even ask. A sharp intake of breath cut off Dan's words, and a pained grimace suddenly took over his expression. His hand shot to the back of his neck. No other part of his body moved at all. "Dan?" Emma yelled, rising from the bed and stepping towards his chair. "Are you?" This time Emma's words were cut off by a cry of pain, somewhere between a yelp and a shriek, as she fell to the ground as though her legs had been swept from under her. She clasped the back of her own neck with two hands and let out a low bellow. Her legs and spine appeared to have stiffened while her hands moved slightly, as though trying to claw something out of the small scar where the messengers had once connected their communications interface. Clark's eyes flitted between the two of them for a few panic-filled moments before he crouched down to help Emma, who was clearly feeling the effects of whatever was causing their neck twinges far more acutely than the more accustomed Dan. Emma writhed in pain for several seconds until her body relaxed and her expression returned to something approaching normal. She took one hand away from the back of her neck, revealing more than a little blood where her fingernails had been digging into the soft skin. She wasn't crying, but there were tears of pain in her eyes. "Emma, are you okay?" Clark asked, trying to sound and look calmer than he was in an effort to relax her. He glanced quickly at Dan and saw that he too was now past the worst of the pain, but was also still holding one hand against his neck. Dan, having felt the initial burst of pain slightly earlier than Emma, only then realized that she was on the floor. He leapt to his feet, knocking his chair backwards, and hurried to her side. While Clark was reluctant to move her too much or too quickly, Dan wasted no time in helping Emma upright. He told her he was going to move her left hand, which was still pressed against her bleeding neck, and then gently did so. With a silent tilt of his head, he asked Clark to go upstairs to get something to clean her up. Clark got right to it. "It's okay," Dan whispered softly. "The first time is the worst. I don't know if you felt it because you're with me, because they wanted you to know for sure that I'm not crazy, or because whatever they just did at Lolo was a bigger intervention than the bolide at Kerguelen. All I know is that everything is okay." "You'll get it on your hand," Emma replied weakly as Dan tried to move her blonde hair away from the surprising amount of blood on her neck. "That's okay too," Dan said. He then carefully wiped the tears from under her eyes with his other hand. "Don't worry. This one is clean." Emma quickly used the scrunchie around her right wrist to tie up her hair before leaning forward and resting her head on Dan's shoulder. "I'm sorry I didn't totally believe you about Kerguelen right away," she said. "When I said it could be a publicity stunt or a false flag or even random chance, if I'd known you'd felt something as painful as this, I never would have doubted it for a second. How the hell were you so calm after it?" "Because I know they're on our side," Dan said, and that was all. Clark returned through the unlocked door with a briefcase-like first aid kit in one hand and his phone in the other. "Phone," Dan said. Clark hesitated for a second before it clicked in his mind. "Oh, yeah," he said, quickly running back up and placing it outside the door. "Sorry, man. I just got a text from Trey. He said something like, 'Holy shit, double happening, unbelievable. I'll call when I'm in the van and it's safe to talk.' He didn't say what it was, but it sounds like we're about to find out." Dan took the first aid kit from Clark and dabbed Emma's lightly bleeding scar with an antiseptic wipe. "Thanks for the warning," she said sarcastically, recoiling at the sudden and sharp stinging feeling. "The anticipation is the worst part," Dan replied. He then turned to Clark and asked him to check on the TV and computer for any live news streams or current trends which might hint at what had just happened, encouraging him to pay special attention to anything related to unusual lights in the sky. So far, the trend ticker had reported nothing of note. Emma used her hands to push herself to her feet, slowly shaking out the stiffness in her joints. "You should check it out," she told Dan. "I'm okay now." Dan didn't need to be encouraged twice. He lifted his laptop from the desk and carried it over to the bed where Emma had just taken a seat. Clark sat at the other side of him, looking keenly at the screen. Within a few clicks, they had their answer. "Is this Kerguelen Part 2?" Dan read aloud from the Blitz Online headline. "Fear and excitement as multiple eyewitnesses in northern Idaho and western Montana report spectacular meteor." The only photograph in the article was a low-quality image from a driver's dash cam, but it was enough to bring a smile to Dan's face. "That's what he must have meant by double happening," Clark said. "First Kerguelen, now Lolo. But if so many other people saw it, why did the messengers make you think we had to send someone?" "We'll find out exactly what he saw in a few minutes," Dan said, clicking away from the article to search for some more eyewitness reports and images. "They didn't give me advance notice of this for nothing, so Trey's footage might show some important details no one else could see. For once in his life, Dan McCarthy had no idea just how right he was. C-30, Lolo National Forest, Montana. Back in the safety and seclusion of his van, Trey leaned back in the driver's seat and shook his head in joyous disbelief. If he didn't have the footage of the alien craft flying overhead, he knew that he may well have doubted his own sanity and memory. Slightly more troublingly, he likewise knew that he may have had some doubts about the footage had it been someone else's rather than his own. The subject matter was so explosive, so incredible, that the burden of proof was as high as could be. But the clarity of Trey's footage, as well as the multitude of angles from his various cameras, led him to believe that in this case, it really would be enough. Just as many people would probably try to disprove the footage as defend it, but he knew that the truth was on his side. "This must have been how Dan felt last year," he thought to himself. He knew it was real, so he knew the doubters would run out of ammo eventually. Trey reached for his phone and dialed Dan's number. He didn't know that the call would be routed through a cable into Dan's signal-proof basement, but he still didn't have to wait more than a few rings. "Trey," Dan said when he picked up, just as excited as his faraway friend. "Are you alone?" Trey asked. "You might want to be sitting down for this." Dan didn't have to invite Emma and Clark to crowd around his wired phone to hear Trey's words. They were already doing so. "I'm ready for it. So what was the double happening? What did you see apart from the meteor?"
"Them, Dan.
Them?
The aliens, they were right here at Lolo."
Emma and Clark both instinctively turned to Dan, but his eyes remained fixed on the surface of the desk. "The aliens or the aliens' craft?" he asked. For reasons he didn't fully understand in the moment, he firmly hoped it would be the latter.
"The craft," Trey replied, giving Dan the answer he wanted. "It was flying, but it was so clear. I've got different angles from my different cameras from beginning to end. This is real proof, dude, and we can't ignore the fact that they were right there before the meteor. I don't know exactly what this means for Kerguelen or what it means going forward, but it sure as hell means they're back."
Before Dan could reply, Emma muscled in to take control of the phone. Dan was interested to hear what she had to say, so he didn't protest. Her orders were simple. "Trey, you need to start driving and you need to come straight here. You need to guard this footage with your life and you can't say anything about it to anyone. We need to talk about how we're going to manage the..."
"What is there to talk about?" Trey interrupted. "This footage is dynamite. I don't think anyone else will have seen the craft, but the meteor was high enough to make sure a lot of drivers will have picked it up on their dash cams. That footage won't be half as good as mine, but quality doesn't count if I'm not allowed to show anyone. Time is money on this. How about if I trim some of the meteor footage? I'll keep everything else under wraps until I'm back in Birchwood. Promise."
"You don't need to promise anything," Emma said. "I know you're too smart to ignore what I'm telling you, which is that you can't do anything with any of the footage, craft or meteor. Until you get here and we can talk properly, you're just going to have to trust me when I tell you that what's really going on here is a lot bigger than some lights in the sky, okay? And I don't want to alarm you, but if you don't follow my instruction to come straight to us with this, if you do anything that lets anyone know where you just were, let alone what you just saw, your life could be in serious danger. This is big, Trey. A lot bigger than you realize right now."
"Jesus," Trey groaned. He leaned back again and rubbed one hand against the stubbly hair at the back of his head. "Dan, are you still there? I'm getting the feeling that you know something I don't, dude. Something you want to say but can't tell me until I get there?"
Emma handed the phone to Dan.
"It's complicated," he replied. "Just get here soon, okay? And make sure none of your cameras are set to upload any footage to cloud backups or anything like that. No one can know about any of this until you get here. And you can't risk any slip-ups. You're not going to be in any trouble or anything like that, so long as you don't do anything stupid. I stayed safe last year by doing what Emma said, and we're both here to help you now, man. We just need to know that you're going to help yourself by keeping this stuff quiet. It's just like me last year. You need to concentrate on doing the smart thing, and then the good things happen later. I know you'd make a lot of money from..."
"Dude, it's not the money," Trey interjected. "It's never the money.
I just don't know why you want me to keep this quiet. Isn't this what you wanted me to see? You did somehow know they were coming back, didn't you?
I can't say too much right now, but the reason I chose you is that I trust you more than anyone else. I know that you're a newsman and a businessman, but I also know that you're a good man and a loyal man. And most importantly, I know that you believed me from the start, before literally anyone else, and that you kept quiet about the Closter letter, even when you could have sold me out. I'm a loyal man too, Trey. You'll do well out of this, but right now all that matters is that you bring the footage here without letting anyone else know what you saw or even where you saw it.
I'll be there as soon as I can, Trey said.
Good. I'll see you tonight, I guess.
Maybe the early hours of tomorrow,
Trey replied after doing some quick mental arithmetic. The hotel signs at the side of the highway were no longer calling, but a short rest or two to avoid serious fatigue would be necessary to ensure a safe drive.
But anyway, Dan, thanks for this, dude. Seriously, it's going to be a real life changer.
Dan put his phone down.
Hopefully not too much of a life changer, Clark said, speaking for the first time in a while.
He'll be fine, Emma said. Dan looked away from the phone at last, turning to Emma.
What are we going to tell him? Everything?
Definitely not, she said. That's why he's going to be fine.
C-29. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. In the minutes after Trey's call, the implications of his remarkable double sighting began to sink in on Dan. If Trey's impromptu journey to Lolo had only resulted in an unobstructed view of a spectacular bolide-like event, that alone would have been enough to externally vindicate Dan's belief that the messengers really were leading him to something. The neck twinges had been enough to convince him, but given the fact that he had now successfully predicted the time and place where a Kerguelen-like event would occur, a time and place communicated to him via familiar but scarcely understood channels, no one could have any doubts any longer. But the fact that Trey's journey allowed him to capture excellent footage of not only the Lolo meteor, but also a bona fide alien craft, well, that elevated Dan's proof to another level entirely. Although there was a necessary element of conjecture behind his thoughts, Dan felt that Trey's sighting indicated that the messengers weren't just leading him to something, they wanted it to be undeniable. As generally seemed to be the case recently, things were nowhere near as clear-cut as they had been the previous year, when all Dan had to do was push for official disclosure of what he had then believed to be the truth. It now struck him that things weren't exactly straightforward for the messengers either. Dan, reluctantly but necessarily returning to conjecture, knew that the messengers could have publicly announced their presence with trifling ease by appearing over a densely populated area and hovering for a few minutes while the world's eyes turned to face them. Of course, they could also have remained in the shadows altogether by not appearing over Lolo while only Trey was there to see them. This brought to Dan's mind the wider point that the messengers could have remained in the shadows even more totally by not causing the Kerguelen bolide in the first place and not presciently alerting him to the similar event at Lolo. This also tied in with the idea that whatever they wanted to tell him wasn't something they could just tell him directly, or perhaps it wasn't something they could risk merely telling him directly. If Dan was right, and he had been so far, and if the triangular treasure map that was taking shape really was building towards his imminent discovery of the fourth plaque, there had to be an excellent reason for the information engraved on its surface to be delivered via that medium rather than directly to Dan. The only conclusion he could draw was that the imminent message was not a message for Dan McCarthy, but a message for the whole world. One which the messengers trusted him to deliver, but one which they couldn't risk being dismissed as a figment of his imagination. He had spent a lot of time over the past few days trying to predict what the message was most likely to be, principally by thinking about what kinds of things they may have come to wish they'd told him during their first and only face-to-face meeting. A new question crossed his mind at that moment, the question of why the messengers couldn't just call him to a meeting spot and drop the newly engraved fourth plaque in his hand, just as he had delivered the blank third and fourth plaques to them a year earlier.
When Dan thought too much about these questions, he felt a growing physical unease in his stomach, similar to the kind he had felt in previous days. He had also read more than enough science fiction novels and watched more than enough movies to know that he shouldn't really try to analyze the actions of an intelligent extraterrestrial race in relation to human patterns of thought and logic. But right now, he didn't have much else to go on. Complicating things further, of course, was the fact that the messengers themselves were interacting with Dan based upon their own assumptions of human logic and understanding. The messengers were evidently highly intelligent without being all-knowing about humanity, as highlighted by their evident mastery of space travel coexisting with their evident need to ask Emma's thoughts on the least invasive way to plant a third plaque which could calm the shitstorm, her words, that had been whipped up by Richard Walker's hoax and the messengers' regrettably necessary intervention against DS-1's launch in China. "You just have to trust the dots," Dan thought, recalling his own earlier words to Clark. "Then when we look back, we'll see how obviously they all fit together." "Can you look up the number for Timo's Cavalieri Observatory?" Emma asked. "Alessandra will be at work by now, and I want to ask if they have any info on the Lolo meteor. Coming so soon after Kerguelen, and especially coming over the continental U.S., this is going to be a huge story in its own right." Dan's fingers were typing as soon as Emma asked the question, and the phone was ringing seconds later. It wasn't Alessandro Bonucci who answered, but he was on the other end of the line before long.
"Emma, how are you?"
"Pretty curious about what just happened over Montana," she said. "What do you know?"
"Less than I would like," Alessandro replied. "You know, given our total lack of access to space-based equipment, but I still have some friends on the GSC's side of the fence, and I already know that they just lost track of a rogue satellite which was supposed to burn up over the Pacific in around 36 hours. With as much certainty as my current position allows, I can tell you that the meteor everyone is talking about was in fact the satellite in question. As soon as better footage comes in, experts will appear on TV to dissect the images and say it doesn't look like a meteor. Then by the end of the day, something will leak out of a GSC facility somewhere. This was an old Chinese satellite, so my money is on it being a Chinese facility. Bad news for Godfrey, needless to say. The GSC failing to stop potentially dangerous meteors from exploding over an island in the middle of nowhere is one thing. The GSC failing to stop a Chinese satellite from falling towards the United States is something else entirely."
"And what's bad for Godfrey is good for Timo?" Emma said. "That's your take?"
Alessandro chuckled. "Without wishing to put too fine a point on it, that is more or less what I was getting at." As Dan mouthed the words "anything else" to Emma, she passed them on to Alessandro.
"And have there been any reports of anything else near the meteor? Satellite, I mean?"
"Like what?" Alessandro asked, his voice perking up with interest.
"I don't know exactly. We just saw a few comments about a possible double flash."
That's news to me. Probably just the different stages of the burn-up. But I'll keep my eye on things. I could certainly ask around to find out if anyone else has..."
"Don't ask around about anything,"
Emma interrupted, briefly closing her eyes and cursing herself for saying too much, and for almost saying far too much.
"I've spoken to Timo about this, and he doesn't want any contact between his staff and Godfrey's staff on this, however unofficial. Otherwise, Godfrey could try to paint it as interference."
"Oh, okay," Alessandro replied. "So is Timo with you now?"
Emma shifted her feet and leaned forward, clearly ready to end the call.
"No, he's staying at a hotel in the city. Anyway, thanks for the info on the satellite. I'll talk to Timo about this in the morning. It's really late here."
"Of course. Both of you must be exhausted after the last few days and then all of your traveling. If anything major comes through the grapevine, I'll let you know as soon as I hear it."
"Thanks, Alessandro. We'll touch base tomorrow, whatever happens in between. Bye for now."
"What do you think is going to happen in between?" Clark asked as soon as Emma hung up.
She shrugged.
"I just meant that I'll talk to him tomorrow whether or not he contacts us again overnight. Why, what do you think is going to happen?"
Clark glanced at Dan, immediately saw that he wasn't on the same wavelength, and just as quickly decided that the only way to do this was to blurt it out.
"Well, you're going to have to explain some stuff to Tara pretty soon because she followed us to Walker's place and she saw him."
"Her phone and Clark's phone got mixed up," Dan added, concerned by the silence which followed Clark's words.
She picked up Clark's by mistake, and we had left for Walker's by the time she noticed, at which point she tracked her phone's location to where we were, which was Stevenson Farm. She saw him, but we sent her home and told her you would answer every question she had, and that the most important thing in the world was that she didn't tell anyone anything about where we were or who we saw. That was on Monday evening, about 32 hours ago, and she hasn't said anything. I think you're going to have to tell her everything because the only other way out would be some other complicated lie that I would have to remember.
Emma's reply was a simple one. Did Walker see her?
He asked us who she was, Dan said.
He saw her, but we were a good distance away and our faces weren't lit up like his was. So much has happened tonight that I can't even remember if I told you this yet, but Walker is dying, like, soon, and he was talking like he felt bad about everything he dumped on me last year.
Death will do that to you, I guess.
Emma nodded slightly and turned back to Clark.
Don't worry about it. It sounds like it was her fault. If it's anyone's fault except mine for letting her stay here without me, and I know she'll never spill it. It's like you two with your dad. The main reason I've kept her out of this is because I love her too much to bring her in. I'll sleep on it, but right now I don't see any way out without going the whole way in. Like Dan just said, if the choice is another huge lie, a big active lie, or telling her everything, telling her is almost definitely safer. She knows some pretty big old family secrets that she's kept even when the people thereabout really tried to screw things up for her, so I know she'll understand. And if I have to play firm at first, like I did with Timo, I know she'll respond to that too.
How firm were you with Timo? Dan asked. Emma shrugged.
Basically, I just told him that he really didn't want to make an enemy out of me, and that he wasn't holding any cards. Saying that now, it sounds ridiculous, but he has this idea of me as being an unstoppable, superpowered guru, because that's all I've ever let him see. He's on our side, too, all in, fully on board, but for the next little while I want to keep him pretty close, just so I can stay on top of everything.
If you want to keep him closer than the hotel, he could always stay here, Dan said. I could sleep either upstairs or maybe at your place, you know, just until you didn't need him so close anymore.
Clark, standing behind Dan, made a stupid face at Emma, his eyebrows raised high and his mouth open in a shocked circle.
"Too close is the last place I want Timo tonight," Emma said, ignoring Clark and smiling more broadly than she realized. "The Gravesen is where politicians and hotshot arms executives have always stayed when they're in the city for business, so he's safe in their high-security setup, and he's happy enough in his suite. But you know, you're totally welcome to stay with me if you want to get out of this basement for a night. I know I would. Tara won't bother us?"
"The basement is fine," Dan said. "I just meant if Timo wanted to stay here. If he's happy at the hotel, I don't have to go anywhere."
Clark's eyebrows fell, his expression deflating as his younger brother's signal reading skills lived up to their billing as the worst in Birchwood, and quite possibly the Western Hemisphere.
"Yeah," Emma said. "That's what, exactly. It's all good. Everyone is happy right where they are, so I guess I'll see you guys tomorrow. Good work with Trey, and Clark, don't worry about Tara. Accidents happen. At least you defused it before she learned anything else."
"Do you want me to see you out?" Clark asked as Emma moved towards the stairs.
"I'm okay," she said. "See you tomorrow."
"Night," Dan called.
Emma stopped at the top of the stairs before closing the door.
"Night, Dan."
Clark stood still as the door locked, quietly looking at Dan.
"What?"
Dan asked, returning his gaze.
"If you could look away from your computer and the rest of this stuff for 2 minutes and just pay some attention to the world around you, right in front of you, maybe you'd have a clue what was going on."
"What are you talking about?" Dan asked, evidently very genuine in his confusion.
"I'm not getting involved, man. I just want you to know that this..."
Clark trailed off, gesturing at Dan's research-covered wall.
"All of this, it's not the most important thing in the world."
Dan hesitated for a moment, as though doing a second processing check on a sentence he couldn't have disagreed with any more strongly than he did.
"Clark, this is more important than everything else in the world put together. Wherever this thing is going to end, it's telling us something huge. You think the messengers are messing around here? We're going to have the fourth plaque in a few days, and it's going to tell us something big, about New Kerguelen or a huge new technology or something on that level.
Clark sighed and softened his expression, as though ready to try a more gentle tack.
I know this is important, and maybe right now it is the most important thing, okay? I know that. We know that. But you need to try to open your eyes to the little things, too. Life will pass you by if you don't, man. Fast. People will pass you by. And, okay, I know I said I'm not getting involved, but people like Emma?
Clark paused to snap his fingers.
They pass you by like that. Someone like Emma and someone like you? Seriously, outside of TV shows written by a room full of scrawny, nice guy losers, this is a once-in-a-fucking-light-year kind of thing. You are a nice guy, Dan. Scrawny as a twig in November, but passable enough on the physical front. But there's a world full of guys like that. I've been around, man, and I'll tell you this. However far you go and however hard you look, you won't find another Emma. Let alone one who's looking at you.
A light year is a unit of distance, Dan said, blurting it out immediately after Clark stopped speaking. A year is a unit of time, and a light year is the distance that...
Jesus, Clark interrupted.
You know, if you were an actual robot, at least I could turn you off to give myself a break, or maybe update your firmware or expand your emotion center or some shit. And don't tell me robots don't have firmware, okay? No one cares.
They definitely don't have emotion centers, Dan said. He then smiled slightly as Clark groaned.
I'm just messing around, man. I heard what you said, and I'm not as much of an idiot as you think. I know we're not on TV, and I know that the hot one and the weird one don't end up together anywhere except on TV. But we're real people. We're not one trait, and we didn't just bump into each other in an elevator. Still, though, unless Emma has told you something she hasn't told me, I don't see it. The night before she left for Italy didn't count because you got her so wasted that...
Dial back, Clark said, involuntarily raising his pitch in surprise. What happened the night before Italy? And I didn't get her wasted. I let her get wasted. I also brought her home before the end of the night and made sure she had some water. I don't normally care about specific wording, but the way you said that has certain connotations, you know? That's not me. I'm not that guy. But anyway, the night before Italy?
Dan shrugged. Nothing happened. I didn't know if she even meant what she was saying. And then when she said she'd forget it all by the morning, I started to think I was right to doubt that she did. So like I said, unless she said anything to you,
it wouldn't be fair for me to repeat anything I might or might not have been told in confidence, Clark said. But I'll tell you what I told her. This isn't middle school. In the grown-up world, people...
So you were talking about it, Dan interjected.
Clark covered his face with his hand, having genuinely tripped over his own words. See what I mean? I never was any good at this stuff.
He then performed an exaggerated gesture of zipping his mouth closed before starting up the stairs.
Okay, I'm leaving. Get some sleep, man.
I'm not tired.
It wasn't a suggestion, Clark said firmly, turning to face Dan from a few stairs up. Get some sleep. Emma has to deal with Tara tomorrow, and we all have to deal with Timo and Trey.
Trey has done his part, and he'll be easy to deal with, Dan replied, shaking his head slightly while holding Clark's eyes. And I've got a feeling that by the time he gets here, we'll all be looking somewhere else.
C-28. GSC Headquarters, Buenos Aires, Argentina. William Godfrey sat alone in his high office, where he had been sleeping as well as working over the last few days. The harsh ringing of his phone was an unwelcome sound in the early hours of an already difficult morning, but the voice on the other end of the line was a whole different level of bad news.
"Explain yourself," was all the caller said.
"Valerie," Godfrey said, forcing a smile in the hope it would come through in his words. "What a pleasant surprise!"
President Valerie Slater, battle-hardened by a brutal few months spent denying that there was any truth in Dan McCarthy's leak and then humbled by the necessity of admitting that Richard Walker's one-man cover-up had hoodwinked her along with everyone else, was not the same person Godfrey had prodded and mocked so relentlessly back then. There was, quite literally, no other leader in the world who had ever survived anything close to the humiliations Slater had endured, and by now Godfrey was not alone in reluctantly conceding that she clearly had a lot more going for her than many had previously thought. That she maybe really was there on merit after all, rather than because she ticks the right boxes for the diversity crusaders, as her long-term foe Richard Walker had once not so tactfully put it. A year on from her darkest days, Slater was riding high in the polls on the basis of doing the basics well and overseeing relative economic and social calm. She had drawn praise for making an open decision to avoid the kind of petty personal grudges which had overshadowed high-level relations between certain other Western leaders of late. She didn't have to name Godfrey and Cole, much less the man behind the curtain in the shape of Jack Neal, but she had publicly stated that she would not be making any subjective comments on GSC-related issues for at least the remainder of her first term. The GSC was bound to have teething problems, she said, and there were bound to be serious complaints from formerly high-ranking personnel who saw their roles greatly diluted, if not rendered obsolete, by the fast-tracked merging of the world's existing national space agencies. Slater had serious reservations about both Godfrey as an individual and also some specific elements of the GSC's charter, but the will of the people and nations of the world had spoken in clear support of a collaborative future for space research, spearheaded by the truly supranational Global Space Commission. Most certainly, the GSC was something she tolerated rather than supported. "Explain yourself," she repeated with no time for Godfrey's attempts at geniality.
"Well," Godfrey exhaled deeply, "if you're calling about the recent incident, I expect you already know that it wasn't a meteor, as the media are prematurely reporting."
"Spare me the bullshit," Slater blasted. "You've got 3 minutes to tell me why a Chinese spy satellite just burned up over Montana. 3 minutes."
"It was a junk satellite, Valerie. From what we can tell so far, an unexpected collision with a small piece of debris altered the expected entry point."
2 minutes 50.
"For goodness sake, will you at least listen to me here? We knew this was coming. We just expected it to happen a little while later. We're talking hours rather than days. There really is nothing to worry about. This kind of thing happens with satellite re-entries from time to time. It's not ideal, but it happens."
"Oh, it happens, does it? Tell me, William, when was the last time an American spy satellite burned up over China?"
"Well, I could consult the records, but I expect your question is rhetorical."
"What gave it away?" Slater groaned. Godfrey didn't reply. "Well, if you're not going to say anything, at least listen carefully. When your impotence and inaction was threatening Billy Kendrick and a few seals or penguins or whatever else inhabits that godforsaken island, I was willing to stand back and tell everyone that you were dealing with it. But when you're so obviously not dealing with it, when Billy Kendrick, Timo Fiori, and Emma fucking Ford are stitching you up like they did in New York, that makes my life difficult."
"Valerie, I'll tell you when I'm finished," President Slater yelled.
"Because you need to hear this, William. When you're seen as incapable of doing your job and things start falling from the sky above my country, well, that's the point when I can't keep standing behind you and telling everyone that everything is fine." "Okay. You can talk now."
"Have John and Jack been trying to get to you?" Godfrey asked.
"I'm not with them on this," Slater replied. "Jack is a snake and I'm not with Cole on anything. This is about the safety of the United States and nothing else. If you don't step up and deal with this, don't think we won't pull out and do it ourselves. I can understand why someone like you might think that stability is more important than security, but that's not a view shared by my government or my citizens. We need answers about what just happened over Montana, and we need them now."
Godfrey said nothing. He had never liked Slater, but he would have long respected her a lot more than he did if she'd always had this kind of fight in her. The GSC chairman was loath to let anyone talk to him in the manner and tone that Slater had adopted during the call, but unfortunate political realities meant that he had to keep her sweet and tolerate her disdain in much the same way she had previously had to tolerate the obstinate and frequently belligerent Richard Walker. But while Slater had tolerated Walker to avoid unnecessary difficulties, Godfrey had to tolerate Slater to protect the very existence of his Global Space Commission. It was no secret to anyone that the GSC's headline achievement to date was fostering an unprecedented level of cooperation between American and Chinese scientists,
and it was likewise no secret that the Commission's life as a meaningful entity depended entirely on the continued support of those nations' governments. This unwelcome dependence was why Godfrey had choked out a statement which condemned foolhardy Western tourists and praised the laudable restraint of our Chinese-born security officers in the hours after an unfortunate clash at Lake Nanso, a mealy-mouthed comment which drew derision on both sides of the Atlantic and nothing more than a cursory nod from Beijing. That had been uncomfortable, but Godfrey liked Ding Ziyang a lot more than he liked Valerie Slater, and defusing a potential powder keg of a situation by any means necessary was a lot more palatable to him than listening to the barely concealed glee in Slater's voice as she spoke to him like he was an intern.
"Valerie," Godfrey sighed, "we're not sitting here doing nothing. We are doing our utmost to get to the bottom of this so that we can issue some reassuring words before the media runs wild with its usual nonsense. Everyone at the GSC, everyone, is looking for the answers you want, because we want them too."
"Then look harder. Look smarter. With the budget at your disposal..." It was now Slater's turn to sigh very audibly. "Is it really too much to ask that you know what the hell is going on in front of you? Is it too much to ask that you know how to use all of the equipment we pay for?
Things take time, Valerie. It's barely been an hour. As I said, everyone is working on this, all out. You'll have more details as soon as we do."
"Oh, I'm counting on that. You're going to give me a full report on this tomorrow," Slater said. "Or you won't like where this goes next. Get to work." Abruptly, the line went dead. Godfrey launched his phone across the room, acting out of full-blown rage rather than frustration or helplessness. "You'll get your damn report," he thought to himself as he stood up to gather the broken pieces. "And then you'll get the rest of what's coming to you."
C-27. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Clark, having been on his way upstairs, stopped dead on the spot at Dan's comment that they would all be looking somewhere else before Trey got home.
"You really think the next meteor-type thing is coming in less than 20 hours?" he asked. Dan nodded without saying a word. "Any ideas where?"
Dan replied by holding his hands in the shape of a rudimentary triangle, thumbs touching and fingers diagonal. When Clark very evidently didn't get it, he added some words. "I have some ideas. They showed me an equilateral triangle, remember? I still think that Kerguelen was the attention grabber, not one of the points, but Lolo undeniably is the first point. So when they give me one more point, the second, I'll know the third. I don't want to get too technical with someone who doesn't know what a light year is, but obviously the third could be either of two possibilities, one on each side of the line between points A and B. I think one of the options will make a lot more sense than the other. Like if one is in the ocean and one is in Colorado or D.C. or something like that. But the worst-case scenario is that we have to look in two places. With Timo's money, we could look in 200.
"You really still think the plaque could turn up in Colorado?" Clark asked.
He more or less followed the rest and took Dan's light-year jab in the intended spirit, but this part jumped out at him.
"You don't think that would be too, I don't know, easy-looking, almost suspicious?"
"Walker has lived here for decades, and more people have looked for the plaque in Colorado than any other state or country. Pike's Peak, all the old silver and gold towns, Argentine Pass, millions of people clearly already think it's here, so it's not like the idea is far-fetched. The devil is in the detail, and we saw how much attention to detail the messengers paid in Salzburg. Maybe they're going to lead us to another Heilig. All I know for sure is that they're leading us somewhere, and we'll be there a hell of a lot sooner than you think."
"I hope you're right," Clark said, reaching the top step.
"When have I ever been wrong on any of this stuff?" Dan replied, speaking lightheartedly but with a firmness that left little doubt as to how certain he was.
"You should plug yourself into your little robot charger and download a humbleness update while you're installing that new emotion center," Clark jibed.
He was gone before Dan could think of a suitable retort. Dan then glanced up at the trend ticker on his wall, which was currently scrolling through an immensely popular recent status update from Caitlin Judd, star of the fortuitously timed and record-breaking movie, The Fourth Plaque.
Okay, guys, leaving aside the movie for now, just remember I didn't write it, WTF is actually happening out there. First, Kerguelen and now Montana. It seems like the messengers are trying to tell us something and we're not listening. Why is Godfrey so quiet? Why is no one asking Dan McCarthy what he thinks? And how about this one? Where the hell is President Slater? Like, hello? Stuff is falling towards us from space? Maybe it's time to do something? Dan knew that a massive spike in social media attention was coming his way, as it always did after a mention from someone like Caitlin. He hadn't seen her latest movie and never would. Billy Kendrick, a consultant in the early stages, had given up a pile of money over what he called typical Hollywood bullshit and what he considered an unacceptable narrative decision to paint the messengers as ambivalent to humanity rather than friendly. But despite having no interest in seeing it, Dan now very much wanted to know how the movie ended and what exactly was engraved on its eponymous fourth plaque. He almost threw up in his mouth when he read that the movie ended with the fourth plaque, discovered after an action-packed and death-defying treasure hunt through ancient libraries and lush rainforests and every other cliched location on the usual checklist, revealed itself to be a stark warning to humanity against emitting certain quantities of certain gases. His issue was not with this bludgeoning heavy-handedness so much as it was with the movie's proposed solution. The expansion of the GSC into a broader organization capable of setting and, more crucially, enforcing limits on the offending emissions. After a few more clicks, Dan saw that the last few days had seen a full-on social media shitstorm surrounding the fourth plaque, with countless powerful celebrities and millions of ordinary users lambasting the GSC's inability to handle its current mandate and openly questioning just how bad things would be if even more sovereignty was ceded to Chairman Godfrey's bloated bureaucratic beast. It had been a rough few days for the typically uncontroversial Caitlin Judd, who was highly charitable and had been almost universally well-liked before the movie painted her as a GSC shill and before the last few days of Godfrey's inaction and lies had turned the GSC into the IDA resurrected in the public's eyes. Caitlin had been kind to Dan during his appearance on Focus 2020 when he'd been at the center of his own storm, and she didn't deserve this. He typed a short private message of support and almost sent it her way to tell her that everything would blow over soon when people realized that none of it was her fault, only stopping when he remembered Emma telling him that celebrities didn't normally manage their own social media accounts. Caitlin would keep a supportive private message from Dan to herself, but he suspected that her handlers wouldn't be quite so discreet. He deleted the message before sending it and instead settled for silently sending her some good vibes. When he gazed again at the ticker, its new scrolling message was a simpler headline about the geographic spread of sightings over the recent meteor event. Still no one anywhere was talking about a second flash or a double happening, much less a low-flying alien craft. "The messengers don't make mistakes," Dan thought to himself as he turned out the light and lay down in the faint hope that some much-needed sleep would come soon if he closed his eyes. He had a mental quirk too mundane and stupid to ever share with anyone else, one which involved mentally repeating any given short phrase over and over again in moments of silence, with a different word emphasized each time. In instances when this grew tiresome, which took longer than anyone would believe, Dan's mind would then alphabetize the words if he was still awake, before sorting them by their number of letters and syllables. As it had countless times over the years, the first part of this familiar mental sequence sent Dan to sleep after a few dozen repetitions. The last version in his mind before his consciousness slipped was the best one, with the emphasis falling in just the right place. "The messengers don't make mistakes."
Wednesday. C-minus 26. Ford Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. In the space of no more than 3 hectic minutes, Dan was roused from an unusually sound sleep by the basement's intercom and quickly found himself standing next to Emma while Tara sat on her couch next to none other than Timo Fiori. Emma whispered to him that Timo had just arrived and that she hadn't realized Clark would have to leave for work so early, but Dan agreed that Clark's presence wasn't strictly necessary for this. He wasn't missing anything pleasant, and he would probably thank them for doing it without him. Timo rose enthusiastically to greet Dan, smiling as warmly as he always did upon seeing his good friend, but Tara remained rooted to the couch with the expression of someone who had just thrown up. Given what he assumed Emma had already told her, Dan wouldn't have been surprised if Tara actually had been physically ill. Her face certainly looked far more worried and frightened than it did angry or upset.
"So it's true?"
she asked, her voice a quivering shadow of itself as she directed the question to Dan.
"Everything was a lie?"
Dan briefly glanced at Emma, who gave a slight nod to encourage him to talk.
"Everything Walker said was a lie," Dan qualified. "We thought everything we were saying was true, right until the night of the DS-1 explosion, when Ben Gold came to my house and told us it wasn't. A few days later, me and Emma were standing in a spacecraft communicating with the real messengers. Everything Walker ever said was a lie. Cluster did actually write the letter, but his whole story was a lie, and neither the sphere that was found off Argentina or the messages on either of the plaques inside it were real. The message on the third plaque was real, and Emma more or less told the messengers where they could dump it to calm everyone down without revealing that the rest was a lie. That's what I really need you to understand, Tara. The aliens didn't want to expose Walker's hoax. They just wanted to undo its damage. Their big thing is minimal necessary intervention. There's so much to tell you that I don't even know where to start, but we have proof of everything, and later today we'll have irrefutable video proof that their craft flew over Montana last night, exactly where we met them. And I want you to know that we didn't just keep this from you. We kept it from literally everyone. The guy we sent to get the footage last night doesn't even know. Before Tara could ask any questions, Timo excitedly blurted out two of his own. What footage from last night? And who did you send?
Dan sent someone he trusts completely,
Emma said, stepping in to field this one. He knew something was going to happen at a specific time, and he wanted someone there to record it. Seconds before the junk satellite entered the atmosphere and burned up, a craft flew across the sky directly above our friend's cameras. He's a professional, and he told us that this footage is incontrovertible. A barrage of questions then flew at Dan from both Timo and Tara, covering all of the expected topics from how he knew something was going to happen to what the messenger's recent return could mean. Among countless surprising revelations, one which Timo was having particular trouble getting his head around, was the fact that an intelligent race of extraterrestrials had placed an engraved plaque inside a sealed storage locker. Dan quickly re-explained the point that the messengers wanted to share the Salzburg plaque's engraving without invalidating the broader picture, a picture within which an avid collector's storage locker in Austria made at least as much sense as anywhere else. He then promised both Timo and Tara that he would get to all of their questions in due course, but told them that he couldn't cover everything at once. Dan himself was quite surprised by how little Timo seemed to know, but on reflection, he considered that it had made a lot of sense for Emma to tell him as little as she could get away with until they got back to Colorado. A question from Timo about Dan's conversation with the messengers at Lolo led to Dan mentioning the potentially important revelation that humanity already had a name for the messengers' home star, but not yet for their home planet. Timo nodded excitedly at this, hoping it could prove useful in the search for new Kerguelen. At the very least, it ruled out a lot of previously suggested candidate planets. Only Tara asked the big question of why Dan and Emma were so committed to keeping quiet about the hoax in the first place. Indeed, Timo so fully understood the chaos that a reveal would unleash, chaos which would be particularly unpalatable given that it would be balanced by no positive outcomes other than the GSC's immediate demise, that he took it upon himself to answer the question on their behalf. Tara accepted the nods of agreement that came from Dan and Emma when Timo spoke, already knowing that theirs was an entirely unselfish silence and now understanding the underlying necessity behind it. "The first few days after the leak were more difficult than I thought any days could ever be," Dan said. "But every day since I found out about the hoax has been a million times more difficult than that. Every day for a year I've woken up and part of me has wanted to run outside and scream the truth into the air, just to get it out of my head. It's been like a virus, or maybe a parasite,
eating away and eating away and eating away at me every single day. Emma and Clark would probably tell you the same thing. This secret has torn us apart. A secret like this tears you apart from the inside like nothing else can. But even worse than that, it tears you apart from the other people who know it. If you'd asked me before this who I would have wanted to share a huge secret with, it would have been Emma and Clark, because those were the people I trusted more than anyone else.